All right, where we left off at the end of last week was getting started on the predatory pricing doctrine. This is the claim that big rich firms, for no other reason than that they're big and rich, can afford to sustain temporary losses, which poor small firms can't afford because they're small and poor. And on that basis, the big rich firms find it to their interest to deliberately slash their prices below the costs of the small poor firms in order to drive them out of business. And then once they're out of business, they allegedly jack the prices up to higher levels than ever before. And we examined one major aspect of that doctrine, which I refer to as the narrow market case. That would apply to chain stores in competition in a given locale where you have only one store in a very large multi-store chain that's competing with some smaller establishments just locally. And there, conceivably, it might be that one member of the chain is competing with one more or less comparably sized smaller competitor, comparably sized in that given market. Let's say we had a chain with 500 stores overall. Each store is of a certain average size. Well, possibly in a given local market, the small competitor might be of comparable size to the chain in that one location. Typically, it would be considerably smaller even in that one location, but it would be possible. But even in that kind of case, we saw that the great bulk, the overwhelming bulk of the capital of the large firm is essentially irrelevant to what it could consider temporarily losing. If we have a firm with $1 billion of capital competing against a much smaller firm with $1 million of capital, the $1 billion firm with perhaps 500 locations is not in a position to put up its $1 billion of capital as a potential fund that it might lose in order to drive out one local competitor. I think we established that the maximum that it would be reasonable temporarily to lose if you wanted to play this game would only be the capitalized value of whatever premium profit might be obtained if you could succeed in eliminating the competition and thereafter not have the problem of any further competition. So if, for example, you might get an extra premium profit in this one location of $100,000 a year, that doesn't mean you're going to put up $1 billion or $100 million in an effort to secure that position. The utmost that it would be worthwhile temporarily to lose as an additional investment in getting that extra $100,000 would be only the capitalized value of the $100,000. And if the prevailing rate of return is 10%, that would mean it wouldn't pay to lose temporarily more than $1 million. And once that's the capitalized value of $100,000 forever at a 10% rate of return. And if you had to lose more than $1 million, then you'd be earning a lower rate of return than was available to you. It would not be very good business sense. Now, if you do temporarily take a loss and might succeed in driving the small competitor out, well, then you've already used up some portion of the limited funds that it would pay to lose on a temporary basis. And then what do you do if someone else enters who has a fresh $1 million to throw after this prize? And you've already used up a few $100,000 perhaps. Well, then you're in a less good position than the newcomer. There's nothing to secure your position, which suggests in and of itself that this doctrine is very, very dubious. It would amount to investing more than you needed to invest. The only way that you could recover that temporary loss would be if thereafter you could somehow sell at premium prices. You would need to get a premium profit just to recover your temporary loss. And that opens you up in and of itself to further competition. So I refer to this as exposure to competition of newcomers who haven't lost anything yet, and it can be pouring money down a bottomless hole. It's not a formula for growing rich. And the actual fact is that the growth of the chains brought about lower real prices, not higher. And I think the best recent evidence of this is Walmart. Maybe there are people who believe that Walmart for 30 years has been losing money on a growing volume of locations in order to drive out all of its small competitors. But they're just waiting. Now they've sunk $10, $20 billion into losses, but they're really going to get us in the end, guys, when they get rid of all of the last small competitors. Now, what was their formula for growth? Well, reinvestment of profits, and how are they earning these profits? Pardon me?
Lower costs.
Lower costs. They were charging lower prices than their competitors, but had costs that were lower to an even greater degree, and so they were highly profitable at the same time that they were charging lower prices, and that was the combination that made possible rapid expansion. Yes, Ms. Fox?
Would also be the fact that they're more efficient in terms of their inventory management?
Yeah, that would enter into... That would enter into what gives them lower costs. So that's where that would show up in having the lower costs. That would be a part of it. Yes, Mr. Trexler.
A comment rather than a question.
Okay.
I was watching CNN, and Lee Scott was being interviewed. And I guess it was almost like you read your book.
Oh, I'm sorry, I have to plead ignorance. I should know, I guess, who Lee Scott is. Is he the president of Walmart?
What's that?
Who is Lee Scott?
He's the CEO, right.
Okay.
And he, there was a comment, they talked about two things that struck me as related to class. They talked about the dominance of the marketplace.
Yeah.
And he just asked the interviewer, he said, what's inherently evil about providing people with the lowest cost merchandise we can? It seems like everybody's benefit.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
maybe I don't know. Yeah. Possibly.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Right.
Okay.
The other thing he said was they talked about, they're getting hammered for medical benefits, not providing a whole lot of medical benefits for employees. And he said that it was Sam Walton's philosophy that, I don't know if this is true, but he wanted his employees to shop around to get the best medical benefits with what Walmart supplied them with.
Yeah.
So, kind of relating that to your philosophy.
Well, I think that would sound reasonable. People are looking more and more to employers. They want someone else to provide for them.
Right.
Their medical care, their old age pensions. And I'm sorry to say that many, many people have a mentality that's not all that different, I think, than people used to have centuries ago, only then they were called serfs. They thought the Lord would take care of them. But fortunately, there were a few centuries in between where people had an attitude that they could take care of themselves. Now, it's made unnecessarily difficult for people to take care of themselves. We have horrendous problems with medical care today, and I would argue because of all the government has done in intervening in it. But it would be doable, and I think Walton's philosophy is basically right. And had this ballot measure passed, requiring all the medium and large employers, they were having commercials against Walmart, if you recall, Walmart should pay its fair share at the emergency room, as though that's Walmart's responsibility, that what their employees do. If they were the property of Walmart, then Walmart would have a responsibility. But the effect of such a measure would have been equivalent to forcing Walmart to pay substantially higher wages, and then they would have had fewer employees. A lot of businesses would have had fewer employees. We'd have a higher unemployment rate, and we'd be having to pay higher prices, too. Okay. Now, Let's turn to another major aspect of the predatory pricing doctrine. And this I often think of as the broad market case, in contrast to the narrow market case. The narrow market case is the case in which the big firm is big, not particularly in any one local market, though it might be, but it's big because it's in many local markets. Now, the broad market case is the case in which the large firm is larger also in the particular local market, in the market in which the small firm competes. And to the extent that that is the case, to the extent we have a big firm in competition with a small firm over the breadth of its market, then there are some other factors that come into play. A good example of this, I think, would have been Standard Oil back in the old days. Petroleum market is a wide market in terms of geography. Oil refined in a given refinery location can be sold over a considerable radius from that refinery. Crude oil is certainly sold over a considerable radius from the sources where it's extracted from the ground. We have the different automobile companies. They compete over a very broad market. If General Motors is doing 25% of the business and Honda is doing 8% of the business, well, they're in competition to a large extent over the whole broad market. It's GM with its 20, GM is on the order of three times the size of Honda in terms of where the competition occurs. Now, wherever you have the large firm larger in the same market, then there's a hugely important barrier in the way, a very major obstacle in the way of practicing any kind of predatory pricing. Because as I put it here in point B, the predatory pricing doctrine ignores the fact that in degree that the large firm is larger in the same market, it has to take the price cut and loss or profit reduction on a correspondingly larger volume. So if, for example, Big John, who can stand for Rockefeller, if he wants to make an imaginary Little Joe take a loss on the latter's 10% share, while Big John has a 90% share, then Big John is going to have to cut his price on nine times the volume as Little Joe. If he's nine times bigger in the same market, and he cuts his price in order to make Little Joe incur a loss, well, Big John has got to take that price cut on his nine times larger volume and suffer a loss or profit reduction on nine times the volume. Now let's look at this in a little more detail. Here we are. We have, we'll imagine the price of the product is initially $1 per unit. Can you see this in the back? Okay. All right, here we are. The selling price of the product, which will be some quantity of oil, is $1. I will assume initially the unit cost is 90 cents, and it's 90 cents for both. And we have Big John standing for Rockefeller. He sells 90 units at the price of $1. This is the initial situation. Little Joe sells 10 units at the price of $1. And so their respective sales revenues are $90 and $10. If the unit cost of each is 90 cents, then Big John's total cost is 90 cents times 90 units. That's $81. So his total profit would be $9. Little Joe's total cost is 90 cents per unit times 10 units. So that's $9. And his profit would be $1. Okay, well now, let's consider what happens if Big John wants to make Little Joe suffer a loss, and Little Joe will suffer a loss if Big John were to put the price down to 80 cents, let's say. So let's assume that Big John will charge 80 cents. Okay, now if he does that, then Little Joe is going to have to sell at 80 cents if he wants to keep any customers. If he doesn't meet the 80 cents price, he has no customers, they'll go to Big John. Assuming, of course, Big John has the extra capacity to serve them. If it happens that Little Joe has to accept the 80 cent price, well then his sales revenues are cut from $10 to $8. His costs remain at $9. So sure enough, he has a loss of $1 instead of a profit of $1. So Big John has sure made him go from plus a dollar to minus a dollar. But now what's happened to Big John? If Big John wants to impose this price of 80 cents on Little Joe, he can't just simply approach Little Joe's customers and say, hey, you guys, come on over and buy from me. I'll give you 80 cents instead of the Little Joe, instead of the price Little Joe is charging you of a dollar. Because what would happen if he could get Little Joe's existing customers to leave in response to the offer of 80 cents instead of a dollar? So now here's Little Joe. He's selling nothing for the moment. And here's Big John. He's still selling 90 units at a dollar to his original customers. Well, what can Little Joe do to immediately recapture some business?
Reduce the price so that he can get the 90 cents
customers. He can attract Big John's customers. And if Big John were charging 90 cents to his customers, Little Joe might be able to get those customers, but 88 cents or 85 cents or whatever. And so Big John would not be able to impose the price of 80 cents on Little Joe. What must Big John do if he wants to be sure that Little Joe has no alternative but to accept 80 cents wherever he goes?
He has to offer that same price.
He has to offer the 80 cent price to all of his existing customers, which means that Big John has to accept 80 cents on his 90 units, which means that Big John's revenues, which initially were $90, are now going to be $72, 80 cents times the 90 units. And notice what is the magnitude of Big John's loss. If you sell for 80 and your costs are, I'm sorry, if you sell for 72 and your costs are 81, then he has a loss of 9. So sure enough, he's made Little Joe go from plus 1 to minus 1, but at the same time, he's gone from plus 9 to minus 9. So this doesn't seem like a particularly profitable thing to do. He can swat Little Joe, but it's like swatting a fly that's sitting on your nose by firing a shotgun at it, which is not a very intelligent thing to do. Now, you might wonder, okay, well, what if Big John has lower costs than Little Joe? Let's assume that. Up to now, we've assumed they have the same unit costs of 90 cents a barrel, or unit, whatever it is. Let's assume that Big John's costs were lower, that the Big John's costs were only 80 cents a unit. Well, if Big John's costs were 80 cents a unit, here we've got 80 cents in cell D4. Okay, and Big John's cost would be $72, 80 cents a unit times 90 units, that's 72. Now, initially, when the price was a dollar, let's plug in our old $1 price again. Initially, Big John was selling for 90, his costs were 72, so he had a profit of 18. Little Joe was selling for a dollar, but his costs were higher, so he had $9 in costs, his unit costs were higher. His profit was only a dollar. Big John had $18 of profit, Little Joe had $1. Now, when Big John slashes the price to 80 cents, well, Big John's $18 profit is wiped out. Sure enough, Little Joe has a loss of $1 instead of a profit of $1. But how much have Big John's profits fallen in order to make Little Joe go from plus one to minus one? $18. So what is the ratio of the drop in Big John's profits compared to the drop in Little Joe's profits?
9 to 1.
It's still 9 to 1. In one case, he went from plus 9 to minus 9. Well, that's a distance of 18, while Little Joe went from plus 1 to minus 1, a distance of 2. So it was 18 to 2, or 9 to 1. Now it's still 18 a profit to 0 a profit, and Little Joe's profit is still reduced by 2 from plus 1 to minus 1. So the ratio of profit reduction is still 9 to 1 in proportion to the larger volume on which Big John has to cut his price. So this idea of the big firm automatically having some kind of inherent advantage is actually more a case, I think, of the bigger they come, the harder they fall, because it has to take the price and profit reduction on the greater volume that it has in the same market. And incidentally, this could be a factor too. In a local market, back in the first case we considered, the so-called narrow market case, if Walmart comes in and it's three or four times the size of any of the little local competitors it's dealing with, if its volume is three or four times theirs on the items it's competing with them, then its lower price applies to that much larger a volume. And if there was a loss involved or a profit reduction, they'd be experiencing it commensurately. Now, there's actually more involved here, but hopefully you see this multiple reduction in revenue and profit. But as I say, there's still more going on, and that is, if a large firm were bent on driving its smaller rivals out of business by making them sell at a loss, it's really not enough just to make somebody sell at a loss. A firm can stay in business for many years while selling at a loss, provided it's covering its operating costs. You can be selling at a loss in the sense of not recovering your full depreciation quotas, but if you're recovering all of your out-of-pocket expenses and making any kind of rate of return, any competitive rate of return on your working capital, you can stay in business until your plant and equipment wears out and needs replacement. So if you want to make the small competitor shut down, as opposed to just staying in operation for years and years until his plant and equipment finally wears out, you would have to sell at a point not just that would make him run at a loss, but at a point that would be below his operating costs. So he would have an out-of-pocket loss by continuing to stay open. And you'd have to impose that loss until the competitor's capacity would actually become unusable. It's not enough just to make him close down. If his capacity is still out there and someone else were to then buy it, I mean, even if you drove him into bankruptcy, if his assets are purchased at a knockdown price, then a new firm using those assets would have acquired them at a very low cost. To stop their competition, you'd have to keep the price way down. You'd have to keep the price below the small competitor's operating cost until his capacity was no longer usable. So that would be a protracted period of time. And then you have further problems, because You can be helpless against the competition of still newer competitors. Just think, suppose it is known. Imagine it is known that you have a game, and your game is you hold your price way down until you've eliminated any possible competition. And when they're gone, and you feel that you don't have to worry, you jack your price way up to a very high level, and you're making profits hand over fist. And this is known. Okay, well, what would be some things that a new entrant might do in these circumstances? Well, there'd be a variety of things. One I refer to as forward contracting, which would be applicable at the manufacturing and wholesaling level. Suppose it's the case that a competitor needs a price of a dollar a unit to cover all of his costs and make a competitive rate of profit. But you, if you feel you're free of competition, you'll be charging a dollar and a half or $2 a unit, whatever. And this is known because we've allegedly had this demonstrated to us. Well, why can't your competitor come in and make contractual arrangements with some key customers where he'll offer to them a long-term contractual price that will be sufficient to cover all of his costs and provide a competitive rate of profit, and also give them an out so that if you decide to slash your price, they'll be free to buy from you, but they'll just have to pay a penalty for the units they don't buy from the competitor. Let's assume that the dollar price that he needs to cover all of his costs and provide a going competitive rate of profit, suppose of that dollar price, 25 cents is sufficient to cover his depreciation and the rate of return on his capital. So 25 cents a unit is sufficient to cover all of his fixed costs per unit together with a competitive rate of return on capital. Well, he could sell contractual rights to his output, and if you decide not to exercise them, for every unit that you don't buy, you have to pay a penalty of 25 cents. And that gives you a guaranteed price of a dollar. You know that you have the contractual right to buy the output for a dollar. So if Big John wants to play these games where he'll charge a dollar and a half or whatever, you have an existing supplier who's viable because he's able to cover his depreciation and earn a competitive rate of return. Now, if Big John wants you to stop buying from this contracting small seller, what kind of price would he have to charge to make it worthwhile for the customers to pay the 25 cent a unit penalty by taking the output from Big John? Here you are, you're contractually entitled to buy something at a dollar a unit. You have a contract that says, to the extent you don't exercise your contractual rights, you have to pay 25 cents a unit penalty. Well, what kind of price would you need from Big John to induce you to incur the 25 cent per unit penalty?
Less than 75 cents.
Less than 75 cents. So Big John can get your business if he cuts to 75 cents or below. But what that means is that Big John is indirectly financing the small competitor remaining in business. There would just be no way to get away with this. And then there are still further things. Suppose it's known the moment the small competitor will enter, Big John will slash his price. Well, if you were the small competitor and you were planning to enter, what would be a good strategy for you in terms of the market? Here we are, Big John is currently charging a dollar and a half. The day you enter, Big John will slash his price below cost. Well, why not advertise that fact? Say, hey people, buyers of customers of Big John, Little Joe is coming, wait. Because when I'm there, Big John is going to slash his price. You've read all the textbooks, you know that that's going to happen. So wait for me, wait till he slashes his price. Well, what will be the effect on the demand for Big John's product before you've entered? Pardon me?
It would increase.
It would decrease because people will be waiting. The bargain price is that Big John will charge. But then, if that happens, and people are waiting, so now we have a carryover of demand from a period where it would have been normally satisfied. Now it's postponed to the time of a lower price. And so we have a greater demand when Little Joe enters. And what would Big John have to be able to do in order to supply this enlarged demand at the low price that he'll charge? He'd have to have extra production facilities to meet it. So he'd have to have the extra capacity to meet the enlarged demand. And if he doesn't, that may mean that some of the customers that he would have had at high prices, they can't be satisfied. They end up buying from Little Joe, and the effect could actually be to enable Little Joe to get a premium price. If you think back to our discussion of price controls, what did we establish when we, as the result of an artificially low price on part of the supply in the market? What did we see was the effect of some part of the housing stock going under rent control while the remaining part was free of rent control? What was the effect on the rents on the part that was free of rent control?
Demand will increase,
but
the supply
won't
be there.
Well, the price would be higher because if we give part of the supply away at artificially low prices, that means part of the supply is going to normally submarginal buyers, and that supply is not available for part of the regular market. So we have all of the regular customers competing for a supply diminished to the extent that part of it goes to satisfy submarginal buyers. And so the price on the remainder will actually be higher. Well, if we had a situation where people are postponing their purchases, awaiting Big John's slashing policy, and now we have a larger quantity demanded at that time because of the carryover, unless Big John has a lot of additional capacity to meet it, he may not be able to meet it all. And to the extent that he's satisfying a sub-marginal demand with his temporary artificially low price, regular customers will be left to scramble for a lesser part of the supply, and Little Joe might actually end up with a higher price rather than a lower price. That's a possible outcome. But then there are even further things. If the item that we're dealing with, if that were a regularly traded commodity, what would be a way that Little Joe could make some substantial money, perhaps, on his knowledge that he's going to come in, and when he does, Big John is going to slash the price?
Have plenty of supply.
Well, here we are. We're starting out. It's at Big John's gouging price. And Little Joe knows the moment he enters, Big John slashes the price in order to drive him back out. Well, if you had an established market in this good, what could Little Joe do that would enable him to make considerable money?
Wouldn't he meet the demand once Big John runs out of goods?
Well, that's what we just discussed. But how about selling the item short? Here's Big John. He's selling his item at $1.50 a unit right now. But the day Little Joe enters, it's going to go to 75, 80 cents a unit. Well, why can't Little Joe start approaching people saying, you're paying $1.50 now. If you wait a little while, I'll supply you at $1.10 or $1.20. And then he obtains the means of doing that by buying from Big John when Big John is slashing the price down to 80 cents or wherever. You could short the commodity. If Big John has a stock that's publicly traded, and right now, up to now, Big John's stock has, the company has been very profitable, and the price of the stock reflects the profitability. What happens to Big John's profitability when Little Joe enters and he has to slash his price on his greater volume? what's going to be the effect on the selling price of the stock? Okay. All right, how about shorting the stock, buying puts on the stock? These would be additional ways, shorting the commodity, shorting the stock. These would be some things that a new entrant might be able to do. And then there are yet other concerns. If we have someone behaving as Big John was alleged to behave, you just come in, you drive out the small competitors, and then the effect is the price is higher than before. Well, how does a higher price for any given product affect the quantity demanded? Virtually, almost always.
Demand goes down?
The quantity demanded goes down, right? So if Rockefeller were establishing a higher price for oil, the quantity demanded of oil goes down. What is the effect of that on the quantity demanded of whatever is necessary to supply the oil industry?
Goes down.
That goes down. What's the effect of a high price of oil on the quantity demanded of oil pipeline, oil refinery equipment, anything directly or indirectly necessary to the production and distribution of oil? It goes down. All right, well, what does that imply about the interests of the suppliers of the industry? Where does their interest lie? With Big John getting a high price or with the price being low? The price being low. The lower the price of the product, the greater the quantity demanded, and then the greater will be the demand for the things necessary to produce it. And similarly, what about the producers of complementary products? The quantity demand, the demand for the complementary products goes down as the result of any artificially high price of a given product. So what is the self-interest of the producers of the complementary products with respect to the price of this given product? They keep it down as far as possible. So if it were true that these large concerns acting Pavlov-like, or like Pavlov's dogs, they would just automatically react and slash their prices anytime there was some small competitor who came in, well, it would be a pretty good idea for the suppliers of the industry and the producers of complementary products to see to it that there was always some little small competitor around to make the giant slash his price and run at that loss, because that would mean a larger industry and greater business for them. Yeah.
So what would be the strategy for Big John then to move the smaller competitors out with all this being said? How would they go about?
Well, the implication is that they shouldn't bother with these small competitors. The implication is that once you get to the point where you're doing 70, 80, 90% of the business, it really does not pay to go after the remaining few percent. And that's the next point. I say implication of above is that it doesn't pay a large firm to seek 100% of the market by cutting price, unless there could be some conditions in which it would. Unless there will be a vast increase in volume. The small firm's minor share of the market is not a sufficient reward by itself. So you just think, here you are, let's say you're doing 80, 90% of the business. To get that remaining 10%, you have to slash on your vastly greater volume. And you have to incur a multiple loss for a long time. And then it's very, very doubtful that you'll ever be able to succeed in getting a premium price. If you leave the small competitor alone, you're in a position to make handsome profits on your huge share by charging a price. If you can have low costs, if you can get your costs down, that'll be the key thing. Get your costs down, be profitable at a price where your small competitor is just getting by. You don't have to put him out of business. You just want to be sure that he's not going to grow rich and be able to become much more efficient. Then he'd be a serious threat. But if you have some other firms that are doing 10 or 20% of the business, they're not exceptionally profitable. They're more or less just getting by, but you're profitable because you have low costs. Well, that's the formula for success. You're not waving a red flag, inviting other people in to cash in on a high price. Your price is low. You have good profits because your costs are lower still. And so the point is, it doesn't pay the giants to go after the last few percent unless there was something beyond the share of the small competitors. The 10 or 20% of the business done by the small competitors is not a sufficient reward. If, however, by charging a lower price, there would be a major increase in volume. If, for example, the overall size of your industry might double or triple, well, then you'd go for it with a lower price, not for the purpose of picking up the minor share of your existing competitors, but in order to capture this major new market. And then the competitors would just be driven out as collateral damage. That wouldn't be the purpose of your action. That would just be its effect. And in order to maintain that large market, you'd have to keep the price pretty far down. Now, a further implication, though, is that while the huge firm does really not have much incentive in going after the business of the small firm as a rule, unless there's some huge expansion in the market, the small firm will have an incentive in being very aggressive against the large firm if it's able to get its cost down. And some examples of this would be, think of the competition between IBM personal computers and Compaq personal computers. I don't know if I made the point that back in around 1985, IBM was shipping maybe 50% or more of the newly produced PCs, and Compaq was just barely getting started. It would not have paid for IBM to slash prices on its 55% market share to go after Compaq's then 1 or 2% share of this huge multiple loss effect. But once Compaq succeeded in getting its costs way down, it did pay Compaq to go aggressively against IBM. Why was that the case? Yeah, here's Compaq, they're starting off their 1 or 2%. Here's IBM, they're 50, 55%. Well, Compaq is in a position to double, quadruple, octuple its business at the expense of IBM. That's a huge incentive. For IBM, getting Compaq's business would be a little blip. So it's the small firm that actually has the incentive to be aggressive against the large firm, because they've got a major market share to gain, while the large firm does not. And you could see the same thing, I think, perhaps on a larger scale, in connection with the competition from Japan, going back to the 60s and 70s and on forward. Back around 1960, as between Little John and Big John and Little Joe, how would you classify Japan? They were Little Joe. Here's Japan, that's Little Joe. Well, if the predatory pricing doctrine were really true, here's Little Japan, and they have a piddling steel industry and automobile industry at the time. And here we are, we have U.S. Steel and General Motors and all the rest. Why didn't they read some of these textbooks and know, well, the way you protect yourself is you just slash your prices, you wipe out Little Japan, and then we don't have to worry about them again. Well, what happened there? It went the other way. That's what happened. They didn't pay Detroit and the major steel producers to pay much attention to Japan for quite a while. And when they finally started paying attention, Japan had gotten much more efficient and was a lower cost producer than our firms were. And they were in a position to grow aggressively against our firms. Now, this point about it not paying the big firms to go for the last bit of an industry, as I say in point four, this is a further reason for industries usually having more than one firm. We saw last week the Division of Labor itself, that can serve as a reason often too, but this issue of the talented not being susceptible to mergers. There was no way IBM could have gotten Michael Dell to sell out on terms favorable to IBM if he's expecting to have a major part of their lunch. no way for General Motors to get Toyota to sell out on favorable terms to it. If Toyota had a realistic anticipation of what's actually come about. So now we see that it just doesn't pay to go for 100% of the market in most cases. So that means that normally there's going to be more than one firm in an industry on top of everything else. Now finally, some historical confirmation, specifically in the case of Standard Oil. I think I mentioned last week that there was a very well-known article written in the Journal of Law and Economics called Predatory Pricing, the Standard Oil New Jersey Case. And I'll just read you a few key passages from it. Quote, according to most accounts, the Standard Oil Company of New Jersey established an oil refining monopoly in the United States, in large part through the systematic use of predatory price discrimination. Standard struck down its competitors in one market at a time until it enjoyed a monopoly position everywhere. Similarly, it preserved its monopoly by cutting prices selectively wherever competitors dared enter. Price discrimination, so the story goes, was both a technique by which it obtained its dominance and the device with which it maintained it. The main trouble with this history is that it is logically deficient, and I can find little or no evidence to support it. Now, the logical deficiency is just what I've explained to you, this problem of the reduction in price on a larger volume and multiple profit reduction. And the author notes, I'm profoundly indebted to Aaron Director of the University of Chicago Law School, who suggested that this study be undertaken. Professor Director, without investigating the facts, developed a logical framework by which he predicted that Standard Oil had not gotten or maintained its monopoly position by using predatory price cutting. In truth, he predicted, on purely logical grounds, that they never systematically used the technique at all. I was astounded by these hypotheses and doubtful of their validity, but was also impressed by the logic which produced them. As a consequence, I resolved to investigate the matter, admittedly against my better judgment, for like everyone else, I knew full well what Standard had really done. Well, he ends up, Standard's monopoly was in refining. Is there any evidence that predatory price cutting helped to achieve it? To discover whether local price cutting played any part in the many refinery acquisitions made by the Standard interests, I checked the whole record for testimony about every refinery known to have been bought. Furthermore, I have tried to check every alleged case of local price cutting involving competitive refiners that Standard did not buy. Judging from the record, Standard Oil did not use predatory price discrimination to drive out competing refiners, nor did its pricing practice have that effect. Whereas there may be a very few cases in which retail kerosene peddlers or dealers went out of business after or during price cutting, there is no real proof that Standard's pricing policies were responsible. I am convinced that Standard did not systematically, if ever, use local price cutting in retailing or anywhere else to reduce competition. To do so would have been foolish, and whatever else has been said about them, the old Standard organization was seldom criticized for making less money when it could readily have made more. So that's an empirical study. And then something further from a book that just appeared this last year called How Capitalism Saved America. I'll read you a couple of paragraphs, two or three paragraphs from it. There is the old predatory pricing canard. True, one might say, the trusts were dropping prices. But weren't they just doing this temporarily in hopes of driving all the competition from the market? This, of course, would have been the height of economic folly, to drop your price below cost for several decades in hopes of someday making a monopoly profit. Interestingly, the New York Times, which at the turn of the century, back in 1900, had already established itself as perhaps the leading paper in the United States, strongly opposed the Sherman Act after initially being in favor of it. The reason it gave for this reversal was the blatantly hypocritical behavior of Senator Sherman and the Republican Party. Just 4 months after passage of the Sherman Act, Congress passed the McKinley Tariff, one of the biggest tariff increases up to that point. This was a continuation of the hyper-protectionist trade policy that the Republican Party had championed since the Lincoln administration. In light of these developments, the New York Times editorialized on October 1, 1890, that so-called antitrust law was passed to deceive the people and to clear the way for the enactment of this law relating to the tariff. It was projected in order that the party organs might say to the opponents of tariff extortion and protected combinations, "Behold, we have attacked the trusts. The Republican Party is the enemy of all such rings." And now the author of it, Sherman, can only hope that the rings will disappear of their own accord. The Times obviously believed that the Sherman Act had been designed to divert the public's attention away from the real source of monopoly power in the U.S. economy, the protectionist tariff. And it was right. In the same editorial, the Times noted that the tariff rates were affixed by lobbyists for the very same corporations that would benefit from the newly enhanced tariff protection. The newspaper also pointed out that Sherman himself had condemned the trusts because they subverted the tariff system with their low prices. Quite an odd statement from the author of the Magna Carta of Free Enterprise. The Times referred to the McKinley tariff as the campaign contributors' tariff bill, since corporate contributors to the Republican Party were the main designers and beneficiaries of the bill. The newspaper considered Sherman's speeches on the bill in the U.S. Senate to be a confession that he was not at all interested in protecting consumers, but cared only about providing benefits to the Republican Party's corporate supporters at the expense of consumers. So I think this is something fairly fascinating, that here we are, we have the supporter of the author of the Sherman Act, in favor of high tariffs and attacking the trusts because they're subverting the purpose of high tariffs. You see, if you're in favor of high tariffs, why do you want high tariffs? Well, because we have domestic producers who can only be profitable at the higher prices established by tariffs. But then we have the trusts, which are undermining these high prices. So the high-cost domestic producers don't want the more efficient trusts, and they don't want the competition from abroad. So they're opposed to the trust. They want the antitrust law to stifle the trust and high tariffs to give them further protection. It's two aspects of anti-competition. And, we usually are brought up to believe that the source of opposition to the trusts was the consumers. The trusts are allegedly gouging the consumers. It was not the consumers who were the author of the Antitrust Act. It was the competitors of the trusts who were losing out. Just as very recently, who was the source of the antitrust action against Microsoft? Was it some spontaneous movement of consumers? They don't like the price they're paying for Windows or whatever? Who was interested in the outcome of the antitrust case against Microsoft?
Their competitors.
It was their competitors. They were the ones who orchestrated the antitrust case. Because Microsoft, its competition was too much for them. Well, it was the same way in the era of the antitrust laws. Their instigation was from high-cost producers who also needed tariff protection. All right, I want to turn now to another doctrine, which I describe as the doctrine of marginal revenue and higher prices in the single industry. Now here, we're not being told that we're in danger of General Bull Moose running the world. That's not going to be the problem. It's a more narrowly focused criticism. It's the complaint that to the extent that an individual business is large within its industry, to the extent that one firm does a large percentage of the business of its industry, it will be motivated not to increase its production in circumstances that by some objective standard call for an increase. It's claimed that a large firm, as an implication of its very size, has an incentive to curtail its production at a point that is too soon. It curtails its production before it should. And I think the only way to make this point clear is by immediately going into an example of it. So here we are. We have this table, which repeats table 10.1 in my book. We have a price for some product corresponding to a definite quantity produced. So we'll assume that when the quantity of some product produced is only 100 units, the 100 units can be sold at a price of $15. And thus the total revenue will be $1,500. If the item were produced in a larger quantity, say 200 units, in order to find buyers for 200 units, the price would have to be $9. This is simply what we're assuming. Now, in that case, the total revenue would be $1,800, $9 times the 200 units. We'll assume that the unit cost is unchanged at $8 a unit, whether you're producing 100 units or 200 units. And understand, even though the 100 or 200 is a small number, we're using a small number just in order not to have to waste brain space on unnecessary zeros. We're talking about an industry whose total output could be conceived of as 100 units. Each of these units might represent 1 million units. We just are reducing the number of zeros we have to work with. The essential is that with the 100 units, they take in 1,500 of revenue. With 200 units, they take in not a hell of a lot more, 1,800 units. Now, if their unit cost is $8 a unit, we can infer the total cost. When 100 units are produced, the total cost is only $800, and the total revenue is $1,500. So the profit, as shown in the last column, is 700. When 200 units are produced and total revenue is 1,800, well, total cost is 1,600 and total profit is now only 200. So what's happened to total profit of this industry? It's decreased. It goes from 700 when 100 units is the output down to 200 when 200 units is the output. Now, I'm assuming that this 100 units, the second 100 units, selling at a price of 9 and having a cost of 8, I'm assuming that those 100 units are profitable in their own right. If you were contemplating, should I produce this second 100 units? And that was your only consideration. You were not concerned with any effect on the price of the first 100 units. You were just looking at the revenue derived strictly from the second 100 units compared to the cost of producing strictly the second 100 units. Well, if you look just at the second 100 units, what's the revenue, what's the cost? The cost is 800 and the revenue is? 900. So the second 100 units, considered in and of themselves, apart from any consideration of the first 100 units, they're profitable. And so from that point of view, one could argue, well, this second 100 units should be produced. It's profitable. The market should produce it. But then it's held, if you look at things from the perspective of the firm that's presently producing 100 units, that's selling 100 units at 15, how will it consider the effect of producing a second 100 units? What's happening from its point of view? Using the numbers that are here in this table. Well, what's their profit when they're producing 100 units? 700, right? Okay, now, what would be their profit if they decided to go ahead and produce 200 units? Well, what's their profit at the output of 200? Their profit is then only 200, right? So at which point is their profit higher? with 100 units. So on this basis, it's argued that if you have a firm that is already large in the industry, as this one is, it's doing the whole industry's business, it will be taking into account not simply the profitability of the second 100 units in their own right, considered in and of themselves, but it will be taking into account something further. And what is that further element that it will be taking into account, which would not be present for someone first entering the industry? What happens to this firm, which up to now has been selling 100 units at a price of 15, and what will be the price at which it will have to sell those 100 units if and when it produces a second 100 units?
Nine.
Yes?
Nine.
It will have to sell the first 100 units at a price of 9 also. So while the second 100 units are profitable in and of themselves, what is the effect of their production on the profits derived from the first 100 units? They're decreased by $600. Okay, well, if 200 units are produced, and if it's the case that to find buyers for 200 units, the price would have to go down to 9, and the price now on 200 units is going to be 9, that means that even on the first 100 units, you only take in 900 of sales revenues instead of 1,500. So what happens here is that even though the second 100 units are profitable in their own right, they yield a profit of 100, which ought to be enough to provide an incentive for their production. Nevertheless, it's argued that it will not pay the firm that's already producing 100 units. It won't pay them to produce those units. Why? Because of their effect on the profitability of its already existing 100 units. Up to now, it sells 100 units at a price of 15. If production goes from 100 to 200, instead of earning 700 on its 100 units, 1,500 versus 800 of cost, it will have to sell those first 100 units for $900 with 800 of cost. So its profit will be reduced 600 on the first 100 units. Now, what is alleged is that this large firm will not be able to consider just the relationship between price and cost. It will not be in a position to determine, is the price of 9 a sufficient price to justify a cost of 8? It won't look at things that way. The way it will look at things is in the light of their effect on the price of what it is already selling. It will be looking not only at the price of a unit when we have 200 versus the cost of a unit at 200. It will be looking also at the reduction in price on the first 100 units. It needs to look not just at the price when there's 200 units, but also at the effect of the reduction in price on the first 100 units. And there is a concept that incorporates that, and that concept is known as marginal revenue. Marginal revenue is the extra revenue that accompanies a change in the quantity produced and sold. Marginal revenue is the change in revenue, the change in total revenue accompanying a change in the quantity produced and sold. Can anyone calculate the marginal revenue per unit on the second 100 units? What is the marginal revenue to the industry as the result of stepping up production from 100 units to 200 units? The extra revenue per unit.
$300.
Pardon me?
$300.
The $300 is the extra total revenue. That's the total marginal revenue. And if you divide that $300 of additional revenue by 100 units of additional product, the marginal revenue per unit is $3. Now notice, it's argued that from the perspective of this large firm that's already supplying 100 units, they will not have an incentive to produce the second 100 units. Why? Because for them, what's relevant is not a comparison of the price of 9 with the cost of 8, but rather a comparison of the marginal revenue per unit of 3 with the cost of 8. And from their point of view, the second 100 units is not profitable because it's only stepping up their revenue by $300 while adding $800 to their costs. It's reducing their overall total profit by $500, bringing it down from $700 to $200. Now, yes, Mr. Tsai.
I see the contract here of this.
Yeah.
I don't quite understand yet still.
Yeah.
Yes. The fact that in the real business practice,
yeah,
the volume seems to be directly related to the cost.
Yeah.
The volume, in this case, in this example, going from 100 to 200.
Yeah.
So in the example, the unit cost remains constant at $8.
Yeah.
When in reality, most likely, in the real business practice, is that the cost would also go down. So what I understand the contrast here, the comparison of this document here, but wouldn't that real scenario support against this?
Well, sometimes it might. It would depend if we were operating with one plant and we could produce a second 100 units with the same plant, we should expect certainly to have lower unit costs. But suppose turning out those second 100 units required a brand new plant. Then you might not have any significant reduction in costs. But even if you did, suppose we changed the example a little bit and we said that the unit cost at the output of 200, instead of being $8 per unit, will be $7.80 or $7.90. And that would satisfy your concern about lower cost, right? But would it make any difference? It wouldn't change the substance of the situation. Now, it's not unreasonable to assume that the unit cost could remain the same if we have to have a big increment of output, but that's not essential. It just makes the example a little more complicated to allow for the unit cost declining somewhat. Now, the point that's made is that the large firm is interested not in a comparison of price with cost, but in a comparison of marginal revenue with cost. And the marginal revenue is always less than the price. Why is marginal revenue always less than price? Pardon me? Why is marginal revenue always less than price? Well, what has to happen to the price in order to sell a larger number of units? It has to go down. And the reduction in price enters into the marginal revenue. See, if we have double the units, is the revenue going to be doubled? The revenue is always going to be less than double to the extent that the price declines. The extra revenue is always going to be less than the price because it takes into account the reduction in price on the quantity that you're already selling. See, when you sell more, to the extent that in order to sell more, you have to charge a lower price, that implies that you have to accept the lower price on whatever quantity you're already selling. So the effect on revenue allows not only for price times the additional quantity, but also for the price reduction on the quantity you were already selling. In this example, the marginal revenue is only $3 a unit, while the price is $9 a unit at the output of 200. Now, this kind of analysis has some application. It can explain why certain prices are where they are. Why do you think, for example, the prices on patented prescription drugs are as high as they are? Imagine that this example were, say, Nexium, the purple pill. And here's the producer of Nexium. They're presently producing 100 units. Why don't they step up their output, bring the price down?
You know, because
they would have a sharp decline in marginal revenue. Now, in fact, in many cases, marginal revenue can be negative. So we've assumed that you could sell 200 units with the price merely going to 9. This is still an elastic demand that we're dealing with here. The total revenue is larger at the lower price, so the demand is elastic, not very elastic, but somewhat elastic. But there are many cases in which the demand is inelastic. And imagine that we had a situation where to sell 200 units instead of 100, the price would have to decline by more than half. Suppose the price would decline from 15 to 7. Imagine that to sell 200 units, you had to cut the price from an initial 15 that you could get with 100 units down to 7 on 200 units. And what would be the marginal revenue in that case?
It would be a marginal loss.
It would be a negative 100. You'd have a marginal revenue per unit of minus 1. Now, in that case, even if you had no costs or hardly any costs, suppose your unit cost was 5 cents. Would it pay to charge the lower price? Suppose you could produce the second 100 units for nothing. Imagine we have a case where you can sell 100 units for 15, but 200 units at a price of 7. And we'll assume the cost is zero.
Yeah, but it makes sense to do it.
Do what?
They sell it with no cost.
Well, your cost is zero, but which is more profitable? 15 times 100 minus zero of cost, or 7 times 200 minus zero of cost?
15.
So you would not be pricing in an area of negative marginal revenue, ever, if you can help it. And the producers of patented and copyrighted goods are in that position sometimes. Just think, what is the cost of issuing another copy of a copyrighted book? What's the cost to the copyright holder? What's the cost to the patent holder of another unit being produced? The actual out-of-pocket money cost. So here you are, you've thought of the idea, you have the plans, the blueprint, whatever. If it's used 100 extra times, and whatever costs are involved are borne by somebody else, there's no additional cost to you. But what would be the effect on the revenue you would take in? What would be the effect on the revenue you take in order to increase the quantity demanded, you have to charge a price that falls in greater proportion than the additional quantity that you can sell?
Losing.
Then you're losing, so you won't do it. Now, this type of consideration could apply if this product here, in this example, if this were produced under a patent or copyright, and this first firm had patent or copyright protection, they could make a choice of this kind. They could say, all right, so long as we only produce and sell 100, we're making 700 of profit, but it doesn't pay us to produce and sell 200, because then we'll only make 200 of profit, we'll make less, or maybe even we'll have a loss. So they could make this decision, and this is almost certainly the kind of thing they do. But suppose that they don't have such a situation. Suppose they don't have a patent or copyright. They have the same configuration of demand, but the case is that the second 100 units are profitable in their own right. What then will be the position of this firm? Is it in a position simply to can it choose? Does it have the power to choose between producing 100 at 15 and making 700 of profit, or producing 200 and making only 200 of profit?
They don't have any power.
Pardon me?
No, they won't have any power.
They would not have that power. Why not? Suppose they decide they'll only produce 100. Then what happens? Then somebody else will produce it, and then what happens? Well, then they still end up having to sell at the price of 9, but it just means that instead of selling 200 units at the price of 9 and making $200, they're only selling 100 units at the price of 9 and making $100 because someone else is doing it. Now, I think this is something very important to keep in mind, which is what I bring out in point 2 here, that that unless it has a legal protection from competition, I say fact, unless it has legal protection from outside competition, the firm's real choice is not between 100 at 15 or 200 at 9, but between 100 at 9 or 200 at 9. So long as the second 100 units are profitable in their own right, they will be produced. The only question is whether they will be produced by the firm that is already producing the 100 or by another firm. In the latter case, the first firm ends up selling at 9, but only 100 units instead of 200. And wherever you have legal freedom of competition and you don't have something under patent or copyright protection, that is going to be the way it works. It will not matter what the elasticity of demand is. So long as the production of the item is profitable to anyone at the lower price that will result when the output is expanded, so long as the production is still profitable to anybody at that lower price, we're going to end up with that lower price. And that happens again and again, even though marginal revenue to the industry is negative. Can anyone think of some significant, fairly important cases in which marginal revenue almost certainly is negative, and the prices don't pay attention to that? Yes, Mr. Feldman.
I was just saying, in the grocery industry, where there's very razor-thin
Well, they have very razor-thin profit margins, that's true. I don't know if that by itself would be evidence of negative marginal revenue. Ms. Fox, do you have an example?
In situations looking at the pharmaceutical industry where pharmaceutical companies want to compete in the hospital market, dropping the price to a nominal price, so in order to get the spillover margin to the retail side. So for instance, a proton pump inhibitor, like you mentioned, next
by me,
sells it for something retail, but they sell it for 24 cents on the hospital side. So they get the spillover.
I don't understand what you mean by the spillover.
That the patient comes into the hospital, they're put on Nexium, they'll leave the hospital, and then they'll go fill a script with the commercial. So they're losing money on the hospital side to gain it on the retail side.
All right, well, now, if that were really their consideration, that it's like giving away a free sample almost.
Right.
They also give free samples to physicians. That sounds like just a marketing expense. I don't know if that would really qualify.
But your sales revenue is down because it's still a book of business.
Well, is your sales revenue down?
If you're selling it at a loss compared to what it takes.
Yeah, but you see, selling something at a loss as an advertisement or a sample, that doesn't mean your sales revenue is down. Because in the very example you're giving, the patient will then have a prescription. He'll want this thing or need this thing when he gets out of the hospital. So that's adding to sales revenues. That's making the sales revenues greater. But I would think an example of negative marginal revenue would be any case in which you have an inelastic demand. And I think we would have such cases anytime something is vitally necessary and at the same time has a very low price. Can you think of any things that are very important to have that you'd be prepared to pay a lot more than you normally do and which you're getting fairly cheaply?
Gasoline, it's not cheap now.
Well, it's not cheap now. What, can you think of any other things in connection with your car where you'd be willing to pay an awful lot more than you normally do?
An oil filter.
A fan belt, spark plugs, There can be a million small things that go wrong with a car, without which you might not be able to drive it, and which you can normally buy at a small fraction of the price you'd be prepared to pay if you had no alternative. So you just think, if it's true that your car depends on its fan belt, that if you didn't have the fan belt, the engine would overheat and you couldn't drive very far, your car would become quickly unusable. Maybe you'd burn out the engine. I don't know what the full consequence would be. If that's true, how much would you be willing to pay for a fan belt rather than have your car inoperable? Up to your valuation of the car. But how much do you have to pay, even at the worst rip-off shop?
Small percentage.
A very small fraction. Now, just think, if there were a reduced supply of fan belts available, if we had a scarcity of fan belts, and there are people needing fan belts to operate their cars, and you just can't get the fan belts, where might the price of fan belts go if people had to compete for them? They could rise quite sharply, right?
Yeah.
What about table salt? What do you pay for a box of table salt? I forget exactly what I paid last time, maybe a dollar and a half. Does anyone else have a different experience? A normal-sized box of table salt. All right, imagine that we had a very modest reduction in the availability of table salt. Suppose the production of table salt were 1% less than it is. And so 1% of the table salt that we normally consume just was not available. And we had to have a situation where people would be made to restrict their consumption of table salt 1%. What kind of price do you think would be needed to do that? What kind of price would be required so that people would, when someone was about to salt his steak, he'd have to take care that the salt really went on the steak and didn't fall on the tablecloth or the plate?
1%?
Well, what kind of price?
$100.
I would say it would have to get quite expensive.
Oh, right.
I mean, if it's anywhere near where it is at present, are we careful about some grains of salt missing their target? Or if you're salting something with your hand and you've taken too much salt seasoning for food, normally you just throw it down the drain. Well, what would have to happen in order to get people to be careful and pour that salt back in the box? A much higher price. Well, why haven't the table salt companies been clever enough to just curtail their production a little bit and make the price of salt skyrocket? And the fan belt companies, because they're not in that position to do that. What happens is probably the price of salt, there are undoubtedly some buyers or distributors that are buying salt under contract with options to buy more at a contractual price. And if any given producer were to simply curtail his production, you'd have the ability to get more from somewhere else. And we have some inventories, and you can be sure enough of the table salt is sold under contract that this would not pay anyone to do a thing like this. Let me elaborate this point a little bit. Suppose you have an industry with a steeply inelastic demand curve, and the marginal revenue is profoundly negative, implying that if production were reduced and the price skyrocketed, the revenue of the industry would be much, much greater. What stops firms from practicing such a thing? Well, it is competition, but I would think that an important form this competition takes is that some significant part of the output is sold under contract. And if it's sold under contract, what kind of contractual price would you expect to prevail? A price, I would think, that would correspond to the cost of production. A price that would allow for a reasonable profit, but which would be geared to the cost of production. Now, if you have an arrangement like that, and especially if you have an accompanying option arrangement where the buyer has the option to ask for an additional quantity at the same contract price, what would be the effect of the sellers bringing about a scarcity and somehow making the price go up in the market? Who would then end up benefiting from that? Suppose here we are, there are salt distributors and major retail chains and so forth that are buying some substantial portion of their salt under a contractual price. And they have options to buy an additional quantity at that contractual price. And now the salt mining concern manages to contrive a reduction in the supply of salt, with the result that the price in the market jumps several hundred percent. Who would end up profiting from that arrangement? The contract holders. The contract holders are buying at a contractually fixed price, but they would be in the position to sell at the higher price. Would such a thing be in the interest of the producers, where they curtail their production, but it's not they who make significant profits, it's other people who would then be in a position to take over their business? So it's not to their interest. They're not in a position to exploit the inelasticity of demand. There are only limited occasions on which it's possible for sellers to exploit the inelasticity of demand, and that is, modest elasticity of demand, and that's when they have patent or copyright protection, if they possess a secret technology, but that's about it. As in the overwhelming majority of cases, the firm is not in a position to exploit the elasticity of demand, or its inelasticity. What will govern the price is what? Where will the price be set? Yes? With respect to the cost of production. It won't be at the cost of production, but it will not be so far above the cost of production as to provide inordinate profits. It'll be geared to the cost of production of producing an additional quantity. And it will not matter in normal circumstances what the elasticity of demand is. The firms are not in a position to exploit the elasticity of demand. I think a further example of this is the price of cigarettes. What happens to the price of cigarettes when the excise tax is increased? It goes up. And what happens to the extent to which the quantity of cigarettes sold goes down? It goes down not very much. So what do you think happens to the total gross sales proceeds of cigarettes, counting the payment of the excise tax at the higher tax? It goes up. And this is why they raise the tax. It's an easy source of collecting revenue. People will buy almost the same quantity and pay the higher price, which goes to the government. Now, you have to ask yourself, if it's known that there'll be relatively little fall off in quantity demanded when the price of cigarettes goes up, why didn't the tobacco companies already raise the price and then pocket the higher revenue instead of waiting for the Treasury to pocket it? Because there's competition, and the price of cigarettes is being governed through the competition and at a price geared to cost of production at some point. Now, when the excise tax is increased, that's something that will affect everybody who's in the cigarette business or who wants to get in. They'll all have to pay it, so that will operate to raise the price. But if we have something that is not raising the cost to everybody, then it's not possible to just arbitrarily jack up the price, unless it would be if you had an exclusive government privilege allowing you to sell cigarettes. There are some countries where the government has a tobacco monopoly. And a government tobacco monopoly could exploit the inelasticity of demand. They could charge such a high price. What would enable them to get away with it?
force?
Well, they don't have to worry about competition because they rule that out. They forcibly prevent any threat of competition. But if you can't do that, then even though the demand might be highly inelastic, if still at a lower price it'll be profitable to someone to produce it, then are you going to be able to continue to get the high price?
No.
No. Then the only way you'll stop continuing loss of business is if you bring your price down.
There's always a low-cost producer, it seems like, almost everything
in the world, isn't it? Well, wherever you have two or more producers, I imagine one of them may be a lower cost than the other one. And everyone has to pretty much match the price of whoever is offering the lowest price.
But it always seems like
pardon me?
It just seems like it goes down. Everything turns into a commodity as it matures.
Well, there's certainly that tendency to happen. Now, it doesn't have to be that way. You could have some products that are premium quality. They could get a premium price. But is there any limit on the extent of the premium? Well, the price of the premium product will still have to be geared to the price of the non-premium product. It can exceed it, but not by an indefinitely large amount. It can exceed it to the extent that there is some premium in quality. Now, I make the point, the last point under A, that no matter what the elasticity of demand for the industry is, the long-run demand curve to any given firm specifically is highly elastic at any price above outsiders' costs plus an allowance for the going rate of return. If we have legal freedom of competition, it is not possible for any firm in the industry in the long run to get a price that is significantly above the cost of production. They can't get a price above the cost of production of an outsider together with an allowance for a competitive rate of profit by the outsider. If it tries, then it will have competition. Now, I also make the point in B that if there's a new industry, if we have a brand new industry that is founded by one firm, it might be that in such a case, that firm will decide to go on charging a high price and making a premium profit until an outside firm finally does enter. So in terms of the example we were using of the 100 units at 15 and 200 units at 8 or at 9, it might be that if we start out, if this is a brand new industry and there's one firm producing 100 units, it might decide it will simply wait for someone else to come in and produce the extra quantity. It won't. Well, if that happens, then what's the outcome? Well, it's simply one more reason why we would end up with more than one firm in an industry. Now, if it wants to earn as much profit as it can in its industry, in the long run, it would have to produce the second 100 units. If it doesn't, someone else will. And so that's its real choice. Will it produce 200 at 9 or 100 at 15 temporarily? Its long-run choice is to produce the 100, either 200 at 9 or only 100 at 9. Let me make a last point in connection with the marginal revenue doctrine. This is a doctrine directed against big business. Obviously, the firms that'll be in that are alleged to be in this position, it'll be more likely a firm doing a large percentage of the industry's business than a small percentage. If you're doing an insignificant percentage, you're in no position to try to work this. But the argument is that to the degree that you're large in the industry, then you'll be contemplating the effects on marginal revenue. And then allegedly you have a motive to limit your production before the point where you should. To limit your production at the point even though further production would be profitable in its own right. Now I make the point here that even though this marginal revenue argument is directed against big business, there's an important sense in which the actual meaning of the argument is a denunciation of big business for refusing to become still bigger. In what sense would that apply if we were denouncing the firm in that table above? If we were saying, you guys are miserable monopolists because you're only producing 100 and you should be producing 200. Well, what's the nature of the criticism there?
Telling them what profit and margins to
live. Well, we're saying, what's wrong with you guys is you're staying too small. You're only producing the 100. You should be producing 200. Well, suppose they went on, suppose they try to produce just the 100. Then they're denounced as guilty of considerations of marginal revenue. So they're monopolists, they're a monopoly because they're restricting their production, allegedly. They're producing 100 when they should be producing 200. That's the nature of their monopolistic behavior. Okay, well, suppose they don't do that. Suppose they do produce the 200. Then what's the criticism? They're a monopoly. Now they're not allowing anyone else in. So notice, whichever they do, they're a monopoly. They're guilty of monopolistic behavior if they produce only 100, because then they're restricting production. They're not producing to the point of price exceeds cost. They're considering marginal revenue, so they're limiting their production. But then if they don't do that, and they produce all that they're allegedly supposed to, and they're not limited by marginal revenue considerations, well, then they're the only producer, and they're a monopoly for that reason. So this is a case in which you cannot win if you're a big business. Okay, this is also a logical time to call a halt, take our break, and when we return, we'll deal with the cartel doctrine, and then finally the doctrine of pure and perfect competition. So see you in 25 minutes. Thank you.